Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
All right, welcome. Welcome to Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. I am your host, Sucheta Kamath. I believe we have been together on this journey, finding ways to connect neuroscience, psychology, science of education, helping children, adults become independent, helping parents to take care of their children by understanding the sciences and best practices, whether they are interpersonal or not. And in this journey, I have met some incredible folks, incredible leaders, incredible partners who are committed to this work. And it is beyond joy for me to have our guest return to talk to us about his expertise and his second book, Dr. Bill Strixrud. Before I introduce you to some of those who haven't heard his previous interview with me, please go back to the archives and find that episode. It's absolutely worth, and more importantly, buy both of his books and his co-authors. But before I kind of kick the conversation, one thing, because we're going to talk about parenting, we're going to talk about this idea of improving connections with our children, communication skills. This story kind of stood out for me that I thought I'll share. So many of you, I consider parenting to be an act of courage. Courage to be with little people who depend on you. We love them, but we may not have the courage to love them unconditionally because the way they behave, act, think, or assert their own rights to be their little people. So the American filmmaker, writer, actor, and artist, John Waters was once interviewed on Terry Gross's Fresh Air. And what was so striking that he was describing his relationship with his parents. And they were very fond of him, even though John Waters was a little odd, I would say slightly odd. And he describes that as a child, he was obsessed with car accidents. And now, if you have a child that's obsessed with car accidents, you're going to freak out. And your gut impulse is to kind of abort that mission, stop that child from being obsessed, and veer their attention. Guess what John Waters' mother did? Now, she did not have a degree in psychology or speech pathology, or she was just an ordinary, amazing, insightful parent. You know what she did? She would take him to the junkyards and walk around with him. And he would be excitedly walking around and say, "Ooh, look at that car that got crushed." And eventually he would create scenes and act out these car accidents. One of the most beautiful things she did is she allowed that expression. She participated, made connections, and demonstrated her unconditional acceptance of this little boy and his interesting, inquisitive mind. Now, it may strike you as odd, but that's just your personal preference, maybe. But lastly, the way he introduced his most recent book, he fondly remembers his parents, and he talked about that. He said, "My parents were very, very conservative, but they demonstrated this incredible acceptance." And he says, "John and Patricia Waters, thank you for giving me the foundation of good taste to rebel against." That was his tribute to him. So with that said, let's figure out how to become John Waters' mother. And I hope our stressors are lesser than hers were, but she was so graceful. So Dr. William Strixrud is a clinical neuropsychologist, founder of Strixrud Group, as well as faculty member at the Children's National Medical Center and assistant professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine. He's also the co-author with Ned Johnson. We have to get Ned on the podcast as well, of the national best-selling books, I would say, the book, The Self-Driven Child, that was published a few years ago, and now it's been published in 18 countries and translated into 17 languages, and particularly you were saying, you have a great presence in China. And they also have this second book, which we're going to talk about. It's called What Do You Say? Talking with Kids to Build Motivation, Stress Tolerance, and a Happy Home. And such a joy to be with you. Welcome to the podcast.
It's really great to be with you again.
So as you heard me talk about this little story about John Waters, I was just wondering, as a psychologist, what do you think about that approach?
Well, you know, in both our books, we talk about what we consider to be the postulates of motivation. And the first one is you can't make a kid do something against his will. And the second one is you can't make them want what they don't want. And the third one is you can't make them not want what they want.
You know, love it.
You know, I live in a very blue state. And when I used to do psychotherapy, a lot of parents, if the kids were interested in guns, you know, they wanted me to try to talk the kid out of being interested in guns, which is just the wrong use of energy. What we want to do is show empathy. Is it's not pathological to be interested in guns. And when the parents changed their energy and just showed more interest in it, bought some catalogs, very often the kid's interest in it waned, went into something else. But I think that when we fight it, we try to change it, kids hold on tighter.
Oh, go ahead, Bill.
I just think it was a brilliant way to do this. And certainly many kids in the autism spectrum, we try to steer them away from their intense interests. And I think in many ways, what we want to do is use them as much as we can.
And I think to your point, I always say that interest is a sign of willingness, desire, and commitment to channel energy. And if there's a motivational mismatch, that means you're more motivated to get kids to do something they don't want to, and they're least motivated to engage, you're going to have battle of the bulges. And people respond to that with further inappropriate ways of handling it, and then it becomes a very unrestful home. And I really love your emphasis in your subtitle, like Happy Home. So let's begin with the first question that I have for you is, the foundation here is, even though you use communication as a vehicle, but you're really talking about the art of connection.
Yeah.
And I think it's the art of people management, but managing people sounds like you want to control them. But you're talking about deep, meaningful, forming connections with kids. So tell me a little bit, what was your thought about that? And as a psychologist, what do you see has changed in the culture that you have prioritized that? Because it's a commonsensical thing. We as humans want to connect.
So we know that a close connection with parents is about the nearest thing you can get to a silver bullet in terms of protecting kids from the harmful effects of stress and negative experiences. And yet, especially in communities where affluent communities and kids in high achieving schools, kids on average don't feel as close to their parents as kids in middle class schools or even kind of lower class families. So we started out, actually what happened was that our agent, when the Self-Driven Child was doing well, said it's time to write a second book. He said, just people love the language you give them in the Self-Driven Child. Write a book with more of that, about communicating with kids. And we thought, well, you know, between the two of us, we've been communicating with kids one-on-one for 65 years professionally. And so we can probably do this. And in our first book, we place a strong emphasis on a sense of control, which I think besides communicating to kids that they're deeply loved, is the most important thing we can do for them, is help them develop a healthy sense of control of their own life. When we thought about, you know, book about communication, ultimately communication is for connection. And so we just thought about what do we know about how to really deeply connect with kids in a way that that builds that strong connection, that builds that relationship, that provides that really protective effect for kids.
You know, I think a minute ago you were talking about Sunia Luther's work. She's been a guest on my podcast as well, who studies affluent communities and parenting. And there are two main issues that you also write about in the book is perceived excessive pressure. I mean, both parties, children and parents, feel incredible pressure to succeed or to do well or have academic, in quote, success. Right. By hook or crook. That means if I'm going to come and drop the printed copy that was in the printer that the kid forgot, I'm going to do it. If that means I need to send an email to the teacher to advocate for Billy's absence, then he missed participation in the project, I'm going to do it. Because then I'm propping this kid for success because the grade matters. Somehow that grade means some sort of admission to some college and then eventually some good paying job. But the biggest thing that's getting compromised is that motivation. Why am I doing what I'm doing? But the second thing also you talk about is the lack of closeness to parents. And I think the barrier, as I was reading your book, and in my practice, private practice, I've seen that a lot, that a lot of parents don't know how to be close to their children once they become pre-adolescent. Something about that change, they become either freaked out or they feel these are grown-ups and they should know how to manage themselves or something. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, I think what happens when kids move into adolescence, pre-adolescence, is that the parents feel they don't want my input. They don't want to be as close to me as they used to. And it's not true. Kids at all ages, they want a strong connection with their parents. It's just different. That we shift. They don't want to sit in our laps and anymore. You know, they don't want to constantly be with us. And certainly after puberty, peers become like crack cocaine in terms of the rewarding effects in the brain. And so we evolve to move away from our family, to focus on peers, move away from our family. But yet, there's plenty of ways to maintain strong connections with kids in a way that they feel deeply loved, that they feel supported, that they feel approved of, that they feel that we're proud of them. I think it's more challenging in some ways. I have a granddaughter in pre-puberty who kind of gives me the message sometimes that, you know, I'm kind of done with you. And yet, very often when I get her, she still clearly wants to connect with me, tells me everything. I pick her up from gymnastics twice a week, and she just blah, 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 blah. And so I think we can do it.
You know, the funny thing is, sorry, this is a sidebar. I mean, it's very much to what you're talking about, but so I don't know, every family has one video sender in their family, like, you know, ooh, watch this video. It's funny. And that's me and my family. So I'm bombarding my family. But there's a great little video that I saw, which just makes me, my heart dances with joy, but also makes me cry to see. So there's a video of these grandparents who are coming out of the airport and they're wearing dinosaur suits. Okay, they're coming to, and the funniest part is the grandkids have worn dinosaur suits to greet them. And so they both have not planned it, and they see, and you see this reunion. It is so fun.
Oh, that's great.
And heartwarming. And I think one thing, if I may say, that is missing the ingredient is play. That not a lot of families are playing with each other. Yeah. They're not being fun with each other. One of the best ways to build connection is that, right?
Completely. I mean, when I used to do therapy with parents and to say, I want to set the highest goal of simply enjoying your kid, you know, enjoying being together, because then the kid perceives himself or herself as a joy producing organism, as opposed to a frustration producing organism or annoyance or anxiety producing organism. And I just think that in both our books, we emphasize in the new book, you know, we talk more about the use of empathy and validation as ways of connecting deeply, where we let kids know that we can handle their strong feelings and that we don't judge them. I talk more about that, but certainly the idea of enjoying your kid and having fun with them, it just changes. I mean, I just, I think enjoy. I used to spend an hour a week with both my kids. I read when they're very little that the way you become close to somebody is to spend time alone with them. So I figured
I love that, by the way. I still do. I still do that with my kids.
I know. There's 168 hours a week, and if I can't find two for my two kids, and so and it changed. You know, at one point, my son, he was about 7 or 8, wanted to play Batman. I had to be Robin. It's boring, but then it evolved into, you know, I play baseball with them. I teach them to drive. We'd get ice cream. We'd do various things. But until they left for college, I spent an hour a week with them on Sundays, just doing something that was mutually enjoyable.
And I got that a lot from you and Ned's relationship with your own children, that there was a lot of joy, playfulness, and a little easy on your feet kind of thing. It was not like all being stuck up and just trying to program these kids to become something. Well, if I can share one quick story about my kids who have graduated from high school and college. And interesting thing that they came down for Thanksgiving and we had a ritual. We used to go to Baskin Robbins to get a sundae, on ice cream sundae on Sunday. And they came down and they still wanted to get an ice cream sundae on Sunday. And we always got one and we shared it. And we did that, even though these are grown kids. So your stories were so relatable to me. Maybe can you walk us through, you mentioned some ideas of fostering and making connections, including eye contact, being present. But one particular thing I love that make me feel important is the pleading request that our children have in their hearts. So maybe tell us, how can parents do that? Sometimes they are not present because their minds are somewhere else.
And I think that, I just saw a study in China on what they call fubbing, which is when somebody's talking to you and you're on your phone, you know, and you aren't really, and you're kind of dividing your attention, kind of pretending to listen. And I think it has a really bad effect on kids' mental health. And I think that there's times where we're just too busy.
I've never heard of flubbing. Yes.
It's phubbing, fubbing. I'd never heard of it either. But I think the idea is that if kids need our attention and we're too busy, then rather than trying to fake it, you know, do a half-assed job, but we say, wait a minute, this is really important to me. I want to get this right. I want to help you as much as I can. I want to hear this story, but I can't give you my full attention now. Let's find a time to do it like that. So the community, I think part of the reason I wanted to spend time with my kids, I wanted them to know that you're important enough to me that I'm going to find 2 hours every week to spend with my kids one-on-one. I wanted to give them that message that, as you said, that they matter, that they're important. And somebody once said that what you should treat everybody like they have a sign on their head that says, make me feel important.
Love that.
And so, we talk about family rituals. I mean, as another way of building connection. I remember when I was a kid, at one point, I can't remember why, but I was going to my grandparents for Christmas Eve dinner. And they couldn't cook or something. So we stopped at a drive-in and got hamburgers and milkshakes. And for several years, we did that every Christmas Eve. And I think that having these family rituals or getting ice cream sundaes on Sundays, it's just another way to help kids feel like they're part of something larger than themselves and something that they're important and they matter.
And, you know, it's so interesting. I grew up in India and listen, my parents, my mother was a 10th grade graduate. My dad, went to night school had a very, very hard life. And in spite of that, they had such a great parenting approach. I don't want to say instinct, but they did have, and we had a lot of rituals. I was, in fact, very fondly remembering this little ritual. So every summer we used to go to our grandparents' home and spend a month or two during, Indian summer, which was very, very hot. And then when we came back, the night we came back, my mother used to make this one particular preparation called khichdi, which is like just rice and multiple lentils and vegetables in one pot. And we all would sit around the table and eat that and just reminisce on the whole summer. And that ritual became like this particular dish became a way to like nostalgically think about the past. And so my mother, who just came back, she was she spent a year with my brothers, and she has now come back to stay with me for a year or so. And I made that particular dish, and we all sat around and thought about our childhood and how she used to feed us this. And now I was feeding her, which was just such a, so I know how deeply that act of connecting through food or rituals is so meaningful, because to your point, we are seeing each other as a fully developed, fully baked people, humans, creatures. So, you know, you, one of the interesting things after kind of really talking deeply about, I'm referring to your book about the, you know, theory of self-determination, how people become in charge of their own selves. In this particular book, you have kind of concentrated on parents. And one of the ideas that you and Ned introduced, Ka, is the idea of the parent as consultants. And in this parent as consultants, with emphasis on language of the consultancy, so to speak, how to become advisors and advice givers. So can you talk us through that?
Sure. I mean, I think that I gave a lecture in Houston before the pandemic, and I happened to mention what's probably the most elite private high school in this area, in the D.C. area, maybe in the whole country. And after the lecture, this woman came up to me and said, "I'm a psychotherapist at the Menninger Clinic, a really good mental health clinic in Houston." She said, "We know this school in D.C. really well, because so many of the graduates get into the top colleges in the country. But as soon as they get a B, or as soon as they realize that everybody here is as smart as I am, or as soon as they get ghosted or their girlfriend won't go out with them, they can't handle it emotionally. So they take a medical leave of absence and come here for treatment." And she said, 201, they simply don't have enough experience running their own lives, making their own decisions, solving their own problems. And I felt for many, many years, in 1986, I wrote an article about we should think of ourselves more as consultants to our kids than as their boss or the manager or their manager or their homework police. Because our goal, ultimately, in my opinion, is to for kids to be able to run their own lives before they leave home. As many kids go to college, and we wrote an article in the New York Times in 2019, because by November 1st, we knew 7 kids who had started college and were already home. You know, they just simply weren't ready.
Goodness.
They simply, there's no evidence before they left that they could run their own lives. And so that's my goal, is to help kids run their own lives. And I think as parents, what we want to do is help kids figure out who they want to be, what kind of life they want, and how to create a life they want. And my feeling is that many parents feel that I got to be on my kid and pressure him to maximize his potential. And what that does is it burns kids out. What maximizes their potential is creating a life that they want, that they're really happy with. And so do you want to comment?
I was just going to say about maximizing their potential. Somehow I think the relationship is to opportunities is of abundance versus lacking. I think they don't have a feeling that there's abundant opportunities on the horizon. They feel this is it. If they didn't act, somehow something is bad is going to happen.
It's crazy. And so we talk about the language of a parent consultant. And I think probably the two most important aspects are, number one, is the language of getting buy-in. Somebody, parents tell me, you know, I've told a million times, or I keep trying to get him to see. You know, and Ned has this great cartoon. My co-author has this great cartoon. It's this dad holding his two sons by the nape of the neck and saying, "Listen up, boys, and listen up good, because I'm only going to tell you this a million times." it seems like such a waste of breath and a waste of energy. And so what we suggest is, rather than laying stuff on kids, say, "I've got an idea about that. Can I run it by you? Want to hear my opinion? I wonder what would happen if you tried it this way." And what I say to kids a lot is I say, for whatever it's worth, and then I'll say opinion or a suggestion, but I want to make it tentative. I don't want to feel like I'm laying it on them. Because if we try to get people to change, who aren't asking us to help them change, as you said earlier, all we get is conflict and resistance. And so the language of getting buy-in, and also simply saying, is there a way that I could help? Right? I was given a lecture in New York a few years ago and happened to be talking about this. And this woman got up in the front row, told the rest, stood facing the rest of the audience and said, this idea has changed my relationship with my kid completely. She's in ninth grade. She's in boarding school. And every week we talk on the phone a couple times. And it always turns into an argument because she brings up a problem. And I say, well, you need to do this or this or this. And she fights me on it. And it just evolves into this kind of unpleasant argument. Last week she called and I just said, is there a way that I could help? And then it was fun. Then the energy changed and we could brainstorm together. And I wasn't trying to lay anything on her. So this happens just all the time for me. And when kids, parents often want me to try to talk kids into stuff, and I don't believe in doing it. I don't believe in trying to talk them into stuff. I say, I'll talk to them about it. And the second aspect of language is what we call the language of no force. You really can't make a kid do things. And I just have great success influencing kids, I think, in a positive way by not trying to force them. And there's a very observant Jewish family that came to me a couple, two or three years ago, and right before the pandemic. And they said, you know, we're really distressed because our 13-year-old son is refusing to have his bar mitzvah, which in observant family is a really big deal. And he was refusing because he didn't have religious faith and he didn't want to be a hypocrite. And said, what do you advise? And I said, tell him, obviously, no one could make you do this. I mean, we can't make you learn your Bible portion. We couldn't drag you from the stage and move your lips. You know, we couldn't make you do it. So no, you don't have to do it. But we want you to know it's really important to us. It's really important to your aunts and uncles and your grandparents. It's really important to the our friends who want to welcome you to the Jewish community. So I just hope you can find a way to do it. And 2 days later, after resisting for 9 months, he said, okay, I'll do it. And then he negotiated. I mean, he said, I don't want to do it in front of the whole synagogue. But he did his bar mitzvah. And after 9 months of fighting, I saw another kid who refused to take his medicine for ADHD medicine for 6 years. And mom wanted me to talk him into it. I said, I'll talk to him about it. I said, I don't want anybody to try to force you. All you got to do, if somebody tries to force you, put it in your cheek, swallow, and then go spit it out. And I'll tell your parents the same thing. But you might want to make an informed decision. You might want to try and see what it does, because some people, it's like turning on a light switch. Because nobody's going to make you take it. If it doesn't help you, don't take it. You tried it 2 days later, and 3 months later, I got a letter from his mom, or an email from his mom, saying he's got straight A's, up from straight C's. And that doesn't usually happen, as you know, but he didn't have any learning disabilities or anything. So the idea is that the parent consultant is that our job is to help kids figure out who they want to be, what's important to them, and support them in moving the direction that they feel is important to them. And God, one of the coolest things that anybody ever said to me is that what I loved about raising adolescents was that every day when they come home from school, you get to see who they're deciding to be. So I love that. That's our job, is to facilitate that. And so we have these two aspects, two ways of thinking about communicating with kids that can foster that.
Beautiful. And I have a little bit non-glamorous term for it. Instead of consultants, I call it pentoring. Yeah. You're a parent mentor.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the framing of mentorship or consultants is you're consulted upon. You do not give advice until you're consulted.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've done with my kids is, one, first say, I'm so sorry, that sounds like a lot. Wow, that's a real difficult problem. I wonder what you're thinking about it. And then second, I've seen you take really complicated decisions and you think very deeply before you act. I'm wondering if there's anything I can do. I'm happy to give you a perspective if you need it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has been very helpful because, one, they always come back and ask you.
They do. Yeah.
And second is, I think they really don't have a great range of ideas, because ideas come from experience. You need some having lived life in a complicated, in spaces. So if you have never had a flat tire, you wouldn't know what to do when you have a flat tire. You can hypothetically tell people what to do, but when it's your turn. So I think That's very interesting phenomenon to me about your approach as you're describing this book about that consultants, language of consultant is very much, you're there to see success for your clients, as you say. You're there to achieve, help them achieve success they want, but you have taken the time to understand what they want.
Well, it's true. And you know, we've been writing about this consultant idea for years, and we think about it in three dimensions, three aspects. One is we offer help and advice. We don't try to force it down kids' throats. Second thing is, as you just said, we encourage them to make their own decisions. And I feel the best message you can give a teenager, besides "I love you and I'm crazy about you," is that I have confidence in your ability to make decisions about your own life and to learn from your mistakes. And I want you to have a ton of experience doing that because before you leave home, because that's how you become a good decision maker. And go with kids. And the third is simply kids need to be able to solve their own problems. They need to sculpt their brain. So when something stressful happens, they go into coping mode as opposed to retreating or avoiding like that. So those three things. But the decision making, as you're saying, we say it has to be an informed decision. Because kids lack experience, just as you're saying. So we say, as long as it's an informed decision, as long as they're willing to talk with other people who know more about a situation than they do, then let them make their choice and go with their choice, go with their decision, unless it's crazy. Meaning almost any reasonable person say, "God, that's never going to work."
And, you know, I've also said to kids that I've worked with, parents and families I've worked with, that, you know, when you have a clogged toilet, you don't start enrolling in a plumbing school. Like, you know, you don't do that. Why? Because there's something called experts.
That's right.
They have spent all their lives understanding how toilets work. We call them plumbers, and they have consultancy. You bring them home. And I think this wisdom to know when it's time to ask somebody is also that self-advocacy piece that you're so clearly advocating for. And I think also the language of no force speaks so much to me. I think I would love if you can shed some light about this psychological fear that parents, teachers, adults who are in charge of kids and particularly adolescent, is this feeling that if I'm accepting, I somehow become permissive. Like if I acknowledge somebody's difficulty, immediately they will be difficult or they will never solve their problems. So I think there's a lot of shaming involved. There's a lot of reprimanding. Why did you not do your homework? Didn't you know? You know, like instead, like, "Oh, I'm so sorry that you have 3 zeros now on homework."
Well, I know. And I think that's, we emphasize that in the first chapter of our book, the idea that first seek to understand, you know, try to understand before you judge. And I think that the empathy, the expressing, being empathic is huge in terms of building connection and validating kids' feelings. So, I was talking to parents about a kid who came home. He was like in eighth grade. He said, "I'm so mad at Mr. Johnson. We took a math test. And he gave us all this stuff that he didn't even cover." And he said, I spent hours studying for it. And the mom knew that dude, you spent hours watching football. You didn't really. She knew he didn't really study that hard, and she was inclined to say, "Come on, buddy, you weren't studying." Or, "Mr. Johnson's a really good teacher. I know he wouldn't put stuff on the test." You kind of talk him out of it. And instead, the mom said, "What I said is that sucks." I said, that must be really frustrating," and just used empathy to kind of reflect his feelings, and eventually said, "Well, maybe I didn't study as much as I needed to." You know, he got there. He got, and that's what we find is when we take this approach of listening carefully, treating kids respectfully, not judging them, that they find their own reasons to change. And we ask kids in writing "What Do You Say?" We interviewed dozens of middle school and high school kids. We asked them, "Who do you feel closest to on this planet?" And often they said a parent, but just as often they said an aunt or an uncle or an older cousin or a teacher. We said, "What is it about this person that makes you feel so close to them?" And invariably it said something on the order of, "They listen to me without judging me and they don't tell me what to do."
You know, this reminds me of Julius Siegel, the psychologist from the 70s, who says a presence of a charismatic adult from whom children draw strength. And I think that brings me to this next question which again, being in your presence, I just have a sense of calm. I know you got this. I can feel my energy. Then I'm adjusting to you. So this really, and you write a lot about this, the way of being present with children, or just being present in reality, or in, and you are a transcendental meditation practitioner. I am a TM practitioner, and I am a certified in mindfulness meditation. I've started something called Buckhead Mindfulness Mondays. We meet in the community. For past 1 year, we have had 22 sessions, just inviting the community to become a mindfulness community. Wow. So tell us a little bit about this idea of non-anxious presence. I think it's so hard, Bill. I'm not sure parents, this one is going to take a long time.
Well, yeah. And so, I didn't make that term. I wish I did. I love this term of a non-anxious presence. And I gave a lecture at a Baptist school in Texas a couple of years ago. And it's a church school. The people who in the school told me that the Sunday before I came, the minister told the congregation, I want to become a non-anxious presence in my family, which I love. So the idea is simply that any system or organization works better if the people in charge are not highly anxious and emotionally reactive. You know, we can be a calm presence. You think about it, as a parent, it's much easier to calm an infant if you say calm.
Exactly.
If you've got a three-year-old who's having a tantrum in the store, you can handle it a lot better if you stay calm. You got a 15-year-old who flunks a test, it can be much more helpful to him or her if you're calm and thoughtful and respectful, as opposed to jumping on and making it worse. And so how do we do this? How do you move in the direction of being a non-anxious presence? Well, one is that we remember that all of our anxiety about our kids, all our worry and fear about our kids is in the future. Because the idea is that I've never found this not to be true. The idea is they're going to get stuck in this negative place and never get better. And we realized that most kids turn out well. And I can't tell you how many kids I've seen who are complete disasters, especially kids with executive functioning problems, with kind of immature frontal lobes, who are a total mess at 13, 15, 17, 21. Who 2 or 3 years later are incredible. I got a Christmas card a couple of years ago from a family, and the outside it said, "You were right." And I opened it up, and it's these three young adults with their spouses, and the parents wrote, "They all turned out great."
Oh.
And this happens just all the time. When I learned in 1992 that this very rapid development of the prefrontal cortex between 17 and 20, which is the first evidence that I saw, that the prefrontal cortex is late to develop. And we know with ADHD or significant executive functioning problems, it tends to be 3 to 5 years less mature physically. So the first thing is just realizing that our anxiety is not about what kids are going through now. It's about them getting stuck. And my daughter, when she was 2, she stuttered for a while. She got so bad at one point that she wouldn't talk. And I've never been more panicked in my life because I thought, okay, she won't talk. How could this get better? And a couple of days later, she stopped stuttering. And I realized that all my fear wasn't about 2-year-old stuttering. It's about she'll stutter the rest of her life and then be teased, that kind of stuff. That's catastrophizing. So the first thing is to take a long view and remember how powerful the prefrontal cortex development is. And remember how many influences on their life, on kids' life that aren't us? And there's that could be positive influences.
And to your point, I think it's so interesting to me that God has given us this prefrontal system, which does future forecasting, and this mental time travel. So when we travel back in time, it's nostalgia. When we travel forward in time, that's a future prospection. Very, very important ways to have the long view. But if you look at all the mindfulness practices, it's really turning off your prefrontal system and so that you can link to your present moment. After. So I think one of the things that my work, I focus, help people understand the distinction between planning with the intention of planning. When you allow yourself to forecast, you're done with planning. Now it's worrying. It's not planning.
That's good. Lao Tzu said, if you're anxious, you're in the future. If you're depressed, you're in the past.
Yes, I love that. And you know, there was a movie. In 2001, The Kids Are All Right. You remember?
Sure. These
two. It was so amazing to me that the adult lens is so jaded because you look at children to be fixed than getting out of somebody's way to let them grow. What a different way. Like, you're becoming this tree who's overshadowing the growth of a little sapling. Get out of the way.
And part of the reason that I feel so strongly about taking this point of view is that we don't always know what's in a kid's best interest. You know, the first time I went to graduate school, I was in a PhD program in English literature, and I was so anxious and insecure that I didn't turn in a single assignment for 20 weeks, two quarters.
Oh, my God.
When I talk with underachievers now, I say, I went 20 weeks, turned in nothing, top that. but my point is, when it happened, that I was 23 years old, I felt like my whole life was going up in smoke. And it literally took me 30 days to realize it was the best possible thing that could have happened to me. There's no way that I should have been an English professor. I felt like an imposter, and I needed to do something different. And I think so often, what seems like a disaster, it turns out just leads to something that we didn't anticipate. So I think two other things. One thing we talk about is certainly from a mindfulness perspective, this won't be surprising to you, which is radical acceptance, meaning for all we know, whatever's happening with our kids right now is what's supposed to be happening, because we've never seen a plan for their life that somehow this is off course. So what we suggest is see where they are right now, even if it's hard, is part of the path that they need to go through to be who they're going to become. And don't go against the fear that they're going to get stuck in a negative place. And the last thing is certainly what you were talking about, which is that calm is contagious. And if we have practices like meditation or other things that make us feel calm, that we can, in fact, that one of the a mantra of the Navy SEALs is calm is contagious, because they go into these very stressful situations and they try to keep calm so that they it's a practice. So I think that we certainly, as you said, I practice transcendental meditation, and I know this family, the mother and her teenage son who had 17 who has autism, learned TM together, transcendental meditation. And a newspaper reporter asked the son, what do you notice from meditation? What do you notice? And he said, TM calms the mind and it calms the mom. made her more of a non-anxious presence, you know. Ned's son, and Ned talks about this publicly, my co-author, so I can mention this, but two summers ago, had a brain tumor. And they're scrambling to get treatment for him. And and his wife was asked, kind of a month into this, how are you so calm? And she said, well, it must be the meditation. She started 3 years, she'd been meditating for about 3 years. So I do think that practices like that allow you to experience that kind of inner state of calm really benefit kids.
And you know, the emphasis there is on the word practice, and the practice keeps insinuating or implying or really, really distinguishing that this is not a gift. It's a skill. And a skill that grows with incredible commitment to repeating and finessing and building a muscle memory.
That's beautifully put. And you know, and we have a chapter in our book called The Language and Silence of Change.
And I love that.
The idea is that we spend so much time trying to change our kids. And really, we feel that especially if our kids aren't doing well, our most important work as parents is on ourselves. You know, it's managing our fear, our anxiety, and kind of keeping things in perspective and remembering how long development is, and communicating confidence in kids and going against that tendency to catastrophize.
You know, and can I give you a little bit of a perspective that, you know, because I was born and raised in India and a little bit of a background of Eastern practices, I find this very interesting trend that has happened. So we have highly stressed lives in Western world. We have heavy emphasis on personal success. And somehow personal success is simply representation of personal effort. And there's an encouragement that you can stand tall and have agency over your life by self-effort. And then these some of the in Eastern contemplative practices that are introduced without the context of culture. So I'm seeing lots of stressed out people, you know, humming to themselves and anchoring without really believing in creating cultures and communities where they belong mindfully. Like, yeah. How do you have a town hall without confrontation? Like, how do you actually, walk into a principal's office and express your grievance because you belong to a community where mindfully expresses concern? And not make policy change or something for one child, you know? Like, so I feel like we need to really bring this back into the context of mindfulness. I love like Ellen Enger's, she says, meditation is for post-meditation mindfulness. So why are we practicing? Because you will become more mindful and less mindless. And so I think really this becoming mindlessness, your own mindlessness can be one of the reasons to cause grief to other people. And you as a parent, your own mindlessness can really be like, you have many examples of parents just not listening to their kids and the kids not feeling being heard. And that can be a huge traumatic experience if I'm a child.
Well, they say that kids listen better when they feel heard. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you have, and this goes so much on that agency issue, but maybe you can share a little bit some ideas for educators to motivate the kids as much as we're talking about parents because how do you achieve the same as a parent? You're in charge, maybe your own kids, and there's some blood relationship that makes you maybe even want to understand what motivates them, what interests them. But how do educators achieve that when they have to do group cooperation and also they don't have time to, in quotes, wait for the buy-in to kick in? I do not agree with that, but I'm just curious.
So Ned and I are working with a group of educators around the country who are focused on student-directed learning and really promoting autonomy, because that it turns out that a sense of control, a healthy sense of control or autonomy, it's absolutely the key to mental health. I mean, think about it. If you're anxious, your thinking is out of control. You'd like to stop worrying, but you can't. If you're depressed, forget it. You have no sense of control. If you have an addiction to something, forget it. Life's completely chaotic. And so and it turns out that the reason that cognitive behavioral therapy helps people with anxiety and depression, and the reason that meditation helps is in part is it increases the sense of control. It doesn't mean that you control everything. It just means you don't feel helpless or hopeless or passive or chronically anxious or driven. Hmm. And so it's huge for mental health. And also that a sense of autonomy is crucial for that self-motivation. And yet in schools, kids' sense of control or autonomy gets lower every year they're in school. And by the time they're in high school, you got to ask permission to go to the bathroom. And so we're working with these educators who are really interested in getting kids to kind of be responsible for their own learning and direct their own learning. And it ranges from I visited a school in Colorado Springs where basically it's a high school where the kids run the whole thing. And the teachers are mentors. They're 10 tours. So they're teacher mentors. And they really consider themselves as guides to the kids who, here's the curriculum and here's the stuff you got to master for the state tests and stuff. But let's figure out the best way for you to get them, for you to get the material. And so ranges from school where that's what they do to schools where they have half a day. We're committed to kids. Kids have all their academics in the morning. Then they have the afternoon, they spend working on their own projects. And so I think that it's not through skillfully. Some teachers are just masters at bringing kids in and getting them to do the teacher's agenda. But I think the future of education is going to be on the student-directed learning, because we have this mental health crisis in adolescence, where the church in general recently said that the status of adolescent mental health is the defining public health crisis of our lifetime. And just some new research suggests that the mental health of young adults, 18 to 25, is even worse. And the sense of control is so huge. And schools have the potential to really transform the life of young people by supporting autonomy and a sense of control. And we think about a sense of control in two dimensions. One is the subjective sense of autonomy or agency. And second is that the brain state that supports it, which is when the prefrontal cortex regulates the amygdala that senses and reacts to threat, and the rest of the brain. And so we can get to that sense of control in part by promoting autonomy or agency, and in part by making sure they get enough sleep, meditation, things that strengthen the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala that sculpt a brain that's just used to being having that healthy sense of control.
You know, and this reminds me of one amazing educator I had, Esther Wojcicki. She's the journalist, American educator, and she actually was the founder of the media. She is the founder of a media arts program at Palo Alto High School. Yeah. And one of the things that she also, you know, you have heard of Creative Commons, and she's the vice chair of that. But I think what's so interesting is in that school, to the Colorado school example you're giving, students are given choice to set their learning goals and truly lead their day to achieve the goals that are, but they're also given this opportunity to see the transfer of these abilities and skills in real life. Like what to be a journalist, like you're actually publishing a paper that everybody's going to read.
Yeah.
Then suddenly the language arts comes into focus, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I met Esther at a conference in Colorado Springs. Yeah, we both went to the school, the high school that I mentioned. And the cool thing is the kids that we interviewed said it's so much less stressful here because we have a sense of control. The teachers who function more as didn't have to try to control the classroom and try to make them do what they want, they felt they had to do. They really supported the kids in defining their own ways of learning. The teachers, that they had dozens of applications for teachers from other public schools wanted to teach there because it's just such a healthier way to be with kids. And so many people get into education because they want to have a positive influence on kids. And I think that one of the guys that we taught, middle school principal, where the kids spend half the day doing their own projects, said, I'm 60 years old and I'm just not going to do anything anymore that's harmful to kids. And so much of what we do in traditional schooling is harmful to kids. I'm not going to do it. And I'm older than that, but I feel that same way. And it turns out that I asked the head of the school in Colorado Springs. I said, how do you folks do on standardized tests? He said, we have the highest scores in our district of all the high schools in our district. And I said, why don't you emphasize that more? He said, that's not what we're about.
They don't even need to.
Yeah,
because it's a byproduct of the environment they have created. We excel because we have agency over our lives.
Yeah.
What a great illustration of that. Well, you know, I think as we close, one of the most interesting parts that spoke to me from as I think about executive function, and, you know, there's so much emphasis on behavior. So the underpinning skills, my inability to sustain focus, my ability to exercise mental flexibility, my ability to plan, organize, systematize, and create a roadmap for execution. All those skills are skills, but they may present themselves as behaviors which gets a lot more attention, and particularly framed as appropriate and inappropriate behaviors, they come across as failure to meet expectations.
Right.
So I would love for you to maybe talk about how you have written beautifully about healthy versus toxic expectations. Can you tell us the distinction between the two and how parents as well as educators can communicate healthy expectations to the students?
Yes. I mean, I think that I started thinking about this in part because so many kids I see who are really intelligent but have executive functioning problems, they feel that their intelligence is like a 200-pound weight because they feel that they're constantly letting people down, you know, constantly disappointing people because they can't perform as well as they want to, as other people think they should. And so I started thinking about this and started reading about expectations. And we know that until kids are 14 or 15, their placebo response is even stronger than it is for people as they get older.
Unbelievable, yes.
And we also know that teacher expectations have a profound effect on kids' confidence, as do parent kids' academic achievement, as do parental accommodations. But healthy accommodation expectations are expressed through expressing confidence. I believe in you. I believe you can do this. I have confidence that if you want to, this is important to you. I believe if you work hard, you can do it. As opposed to saying, you got to get those B's up to A's. You know, that's unacceptable. And so because you started out talking about unconditional love. And I believe in telling kids, I love you no matter what you say, what you do, what you achieve, or how hard you work. Mm. I love you just as much if you're a slacker, I love you just as much. And I think that attitude helps kids find their own motivation and find themselves. And so I think that the idea is healthy expectations, communicate that unconditional love and approval and express through confidence in kids. And I believe that you can meet your own goals. Accomplish things you
love that.
And the toxic is where it's conditional, where it's a demand because it feels threatening. And we know that kids function best in environments characterized by high challenge and low threat. And when the idea is, and so many kids tell me, God, they think they are their grades. They get a B, they can't go home and show it to their parents because their parents will go ballistic. This is toxic stuff. And it's all based on the crazy, crazy idea, in my opinion, that the most important outcome of a kid's life, their young life, is where they go to college, as opposed to what kind of brain they're sculpting and who kind of person they're becoming. And when you look at the mental health problems in college, at college level, you think, we got to start talking with kids about what really makes people happy, which is one of my passions now because I was talking to these kids in Houston. I made several trips to Texas, but I was talking with the student leaders one time, and I said, "How many of you want to be happy as adults?" And they all kind of sheepishly raised their hand. Like, "Duh, okay, yeah." I said, "Well, what do you understand it takes to be happy in adult life?" And this one kid said,
"Probably."
Well, they said, "We understand that if we can do a good enough college, everything's set." And I'm going, oh my God, how could they be so far? Has nobody told them about Lori Santos, the psychology professor at Yale who lived with Yale undergraduates, and was struck by how they got themselves in the most elite college in the country, arguably, maybe in the world, arguably. And yet they didn't enjoy anything about being Yale. They were so stressed, so tired, so competitive with each other. They didn't enjoy anything about it. So she started teaching a course on the science of happiness. It quickly became the most popular course in the history of Yale University. And these young people, it's like, why didn't somebody tell me that achievement, it's important, but it's a really small part of what makes you happy. Your relationships are more important. Doing things that are meaningful, being deeply engaged in something you really care about. These are the things that really make you happy. Achievement's not trivial, but it's like 20, maybe 10, 20% of what really makes you happy. And I think so many kids grow up without having any sense of this at all because we focus so much on achievement and prestige.
And, you know, I think there's a fantastic book that has given me some tremendous insight into why two books, actually. One is called Nobody's Normal by Richard Roy Grinker. He's an anthropologist.
Yeah.
And the history of normal, like where we got this concept of people are, and the work, and second book is called Work Won't Love You Back. And I think this identity that I am as good as the work I do is the bane of a cultural whenever you go, people ask you two questions: what's your name and what do you do?
Yeah.
And then if you're a stay-home mom, you almost do nothing. If you have anything non-influential job, you are nothing, you know? But right. This idea that what is non-influential job is becoming even narrower and narrower and narrower. So to your point, I think I really love this, I believe in you, I love you. And the expectation is you do right by you. And I really think one of the things that I say often to educators and parents that, you know, I think hard work is hard. And teach children to love hard work.
Yeah.
Because hard work, it leads to this very inner psychosocial emotional state called pride in your work. And I think that can sustain you, that just pride that I do right things because I enjoy them. Like even, it was so cute. My husband was emptying trash on Thursday night and to trash days Friday. And a self-respecting man that he is. And he not only removes the bag, he props that so everything goes down, removes the air bubble, ties it twice so there's no leak. And now people may think like, why care? Just throw it, dump it in the... And then he replaced the trash bag. And I was just standing there watching this with glee. Like the joy and pride that he felt doing right by his home, you know, whatever it is. Same yeah. thing. I get up in the morning, I make my bed. Like I feel when I put, my mom was so funny. She was telling me the story. I you know, when I remove my clothes, I remove the sleeves so they're proper. So when you come out, yeah. when it comes out of, so I'm future prospecting. Yeah. But I think that joy, not that I'm being like, I'm not telling anybody to do it. But just feeling the sense of pride and joy of doing right by whatever that may be
is beautiful.
Wonderful. Anyways.
Beautiful. I love it. I tell kids, I want you to work hard. I want you to play hard. And I want you to rest hard.
Yes. Rest. So we did not get time, but I think people, listeners, this is one of the most fabulous books. So since we are on YouTube, I'm going to show you the book. So please check it out. Please buy it. If you're lucky and you have friends, you might even get some signed copies. I thought I had a signed copy. So this is my signed copy. I'm so grateful for you being here. As we end our episode, Bill, I always ask, which you did last time, but do you have any new book recommendations for our audience?
Well, I like... There's a new book. What is it? Something is about focus. You know what I'm talking about? Journalist. I'm just blanking.
Johan.
Johan.
Harry.
Yeah, Johan Harry. You got it. That's right. It's about why we can't focus as well as we used to. And I don't agree with everything in it, but there's a lot of really interesting things in it. And I like that.
Love that.
Yeah, I keep going back to Madeline Levine's book, The Price of Privilege, which talks about Sunya Luther's research. Because so many of the families that I work with, and so many of the people who buy books, are in affluent communities and in high achieving schools, and I think so many people don't know that these kids in affluent communities and high achieving schools are so much higher risk than other kids are. For depression, anxiety, and substance use disorders, so I continue to go back to that. There's an interesting article. You know the construct of learned helplessness?
Yes.
Yes. So it's something developed in the 1970s and 80s, and the idea, the paradigm was these dogs would be in a cage and they'd be shocked and they couldn't escape. And so they had that experience several times, and eventually they'd open the cage door that the dogs wouldn't even try to get out. So the scientists, Martin Seligman and Steve Mayer, concluded that these dogs learned helpless. What can I do? Why bother trying? And they wrote an article called Learned Helplessness at 50. This is in 2017. It's what we got right and what we got wrong. And what they got wrong was the dogs didn't learn helplessness. They failed to learn control. They failed to learn that sense of control. That they can, because when you have that experience of controlling a stressful situation, what happens is your prefrontal cortex activates. You go into coping mode and try to figure out what to do. And whenever your prefrontal cortex activates, it dampens down the stress response. And that's ideally, that's why we say support kids in solving their own problems, because we want kids to have a lot of experience. Something stressful happens, and rather than swooping in to save them, let them figure it out. Let them prefrontal cortex activate, because then they get less stress. When you're coping with something, it's not that stressful. What's really stressful is when you don't know what to do. where you feel overwhelmed.
And so, By the way, did you know that this was discovered by Pavlov? So
tell me.
So I was at the trauma conference with Bessel van der Kolk 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And he mentioned this story that Pavlov had a lab, and he's most known for this Pavlov's reflex, right?
Right,
but he had these dogs in cages, and the river flooded. And the river next to his clinic or his lab flooded, and all the water came into the lab. And all the dogs that were caged and nobody was there, they tried to stand on their toes to survive. The water came to very top of the cage. And then what happened is the water level subsided. When they returned back to the lab, they saw that these dogs were unable to participate in any experiments they were conducting.
Were unable.
So they were unable to participate in the previous ongoing research. So the lab assistant came to Pavlov and said, we need to get rid of these dogs. They're just not performing. And so then Pavlov said, wait, but why? And then he began to work on them and understood that even when the cages, because they had this traumatic experience of being locked in the cages and the flood happened, even when the cage doors were open, they were unable to activate their agency. Mm-hmm. Completely lost bearing about their sense of control.
It turns out that what happens is that actually that rather than learning, you know, there's nothing I can do. What happens is that the part of the brain that we have the fight, flight, or freeze. The part of that triggers the freeze response. Is what happens, and so you know that they won't do anything, as opposed to why bother trying? It's just that they're so panicked that they freeze.
Yeah. Well, we were supposed to end a minute earlier, so sorry, guys. But that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, Bill, for being our guest. Your conversations you're bringing and highlighting this incredible understanding that our parents and educators need to have. We collectively as society, you don't even need to be a parent or an educator. Yeah. If you're running teams, if you are a young person part of a team, you need to understand how to really find motivation or motivating people. Don't we all want to yield group cooperation? Well, people are likely to pursue goals that are important to them, and having a good read on what's important to people can be really, really powerful.
Yeah.
So listeners, keep listening, keep leaving us review. If you loved what you're hearing, please share and follow us on social media, and definitely don't forget to purchase amazing books that our guest Dr. Stixrud has written with his co-author Ned. And thank you so much for your time, and thanks, Bill, for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's really fun.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.